Hi, Paul Barclay with you for another big week of big ideas here on RN or on the web at abc.net.au/radionational. Just follow the prompts to big ideas, or you can tweet us or follow us at RN Big Ideas. Tonight, one woman's story of being Aboriginal in contemporary Australia, of loathing sleeping under the stars, of not speaking her traditional language, of enjoying shopping, of writing chick lit. In other words, it's a story that challenges our stereotype of what it is to be black. Anita Heiss has written a memoir entitled Am I Black Enough for You? It's a cheeky but also particularly pointed book title when you consider she was one of nine Indigenous Australians who took columnist Andrew Bolt and his publishers to court and won. The federal court found both he and the Herald and Weekly Times had contravened the Racial Discrimination Act. Andrew Bolt called it a terrible day for freedom of speech in this country, and the matter has refused to go away, spilling over in recent times onto the Amazon.com webpage for Anita Heiss's book. But there is much more to Anita Heiss than the Andrew Bolt litigation. She's a successful commercial author, a winner of deadly awards. She's got a PhD, worked as an academic. She campaigns for Aboriginal literacy. She's very funny. And as you'll hear, she's got a big personality. So let me take you to the Avid Reader bookstore in Brisbane and this conversation with Anita Heiss, recorded late last month. I asked her to describe the moment when she first read the Andrew Bolt article and how she responded to it.
I woke up on a normal day, that I have in my little suburban place at Matraville, which is strategically placed between Long Bay Jail, Malabar Sewerage Works and Oracle Industrial Estate. Perfect setting for creative inspiration. And turned on the computer and there's a Google alert about this article that I skimmed really quickly because I had lots of other things I needed to do and saw all these untruths about me, but not only me, a number of people that I know quite well, some of them close friends of mine, Tara June Winch, Larissa Berent and so forth, and wondered straight away, couldn't believe it, what I was reading was in the public domain for a number of reasons. One, because it was full of all these untruths. Two, because I wondered how it got through an editing process, and I write for a living, so I'm always looking for these sort of things. And really quickly posted it on Facebook and then raced off to do the things I needed to do for that day. And in that period of time, within a couple of hours, obviously the story had been syndicated and it was run throughout the country and so forth, and I'm getting text messages and phone calls and Facebook's going crazy. And my mother, I was driving along Southern Cross Drive going into Redfern, and I rang Larissa straight away and I go, like, have you seen this article? And of course, by 11 o'clock, everybody had seen it. Had a quick talk. My phone rang, it's mum. My mother was born on a Rambie mission in Cowra, and she hadn't seen the article, but she'd been called from someone in Adelaide telling her what was in the story, and she was really, really upset that he had described her as part Aboriginal because it had denied her her own family history and story, and was a slight against her parents. And I was trying to appease her, saying, you know, Mum, this opinion columnist, he does this, and, you know, tomorrow it'll be refugees or gay people or, you know, somebody else who's not bourgeois, white, middle class, and, you know, it'll be fish and chip wrapper, which is what I thought at the time. I had no idea it was going to come to what it did. And, of course, within 24 hours, I'm getting phone calls left, right and centre, and it's become, people are angry. I get a call from the Courier Mail saying, will you comment? And I was like, why are we using space in our media to give breath and life to something we know is appalling and wrong? And Kirsty Parker, who's the editor, had said to me, we've had been contacted from people around the country who are angry. And so, you know, we ran something. And then about 5 days later, I got... Do you want me to keep going?
You keep going.
Yeah. 5 days later, I got... because I can do this. 5 days later, I get a phone call from Tarawiri, which is the Aboriginal... Students Legal Association in Victoria, saying some of their members saw this as a very important issue to pick up because they had been dealing with these sort of comments that Andrew Bolt had been perpetuating in his articles. He'd written about 9 or 10 articles in the previous 12 months about blackfellas alone. I'm the one apparently making a career about, you know, writing about blackfellas. He would have made more money in 1 year than I'll make in a lifetime writing about us.
And what he was essentially alleging, yep. And correct me if this is an incorrect summary, he's alleging that people who are fair-skinned Aborigines, firstly, casting doubt over whether people whose skin is fair are really Aborigines anyway, to gain financial benefit from that, isn't he?
Oh, well, I'll pick you up on that. He wasn't alleging. He was stating as fact. He was putting into the public domain his opinion, but stating as fact that 17 of these people, including myself, had chosen to identify as Aboriginal people to better for financial gain and political purpose and so forth. We were light-skinned Aborigines. We were white Aborigines. We were political Aborigines. And can I say, only at the age of 43 have I ever been have I been the light one in the room. Right, my entire life I've been the dark one at the table, in the office, in most places. I was the Abo Boon Coon chocolate drop and cocoa pop at school, and then at the age of 43 there's a whole new terminology that's being talked about in about me, that I'm turning on Media Watch and seeing, you know, images of myself and being referred to as a light-skinned Aborigine. So he was basically, the premise was, you can't possibly look like Anita Heiss, you cannot go to a private school, you cannot live in the city, you cannot have a non-Indigenous parent and still identify. But what, when you unpack that, which nobody really did, is what I think he was saying, why would you must be getting something out of this? Why would you say you're Aboriginal if you weren't getting something out of this? So what he was saying is, it's bad to be black in Australia. And in order to be black, you have to look a certain way. You have to be unemployed, uneducated, disadvantaged. Now, we had a We had a civil rights movement in this country to ensure that we had access to education, housing, employment, and so forth. And then all of a sudden, when we actually used the opportunities that our people marched for and went without for, well, nearly two centuries, all of a sudden we can't be that person. So there were so many. I mean, I looked at that article in two ways. One was the issue about confusing even further the Australian public about what it means to be Aboriginal in Australia today, and also the issue of people in positions of power, i.e. journalists and broadcasters, not being held to account for what they put into the public domain, especially given the readership of that newspaper and a lot of Australians getting, unfortunately, getting their education from the media. Mm.
So at what point did you decide that it wasn't just offensive and wrong, but something had to be done about it? Because as you said, your first response was, you know, this is terrible, but you weren't thinking initially that you'd go to court. When did you decide to take that action?
Look, it wasn't a decision I made easily, and I'll tell you, it was traumatic. It's 3 years, coming up for 3 years since that first appeared, and I still get upset about that because it took a chunk of time out of my life that I didn't know it was going to take. You know, it didn't matter what I was doing. I had this dark cloud going, oh, I've got to go to court at some point against this man who doesn't even know me to defend the right to be who I am. But, you know, I had lots of conversations. Some of my closest friends are Indigenous lawyers, obviously Robin Quiggan and Terry Janke, who I've known for 20-odd years, and Larissa. We all went to university together, and they're all lawyers. And I rang Larissa and said, look, I don't know about the law. You know, I write books. Not even that well, you know. I was guided by people who said to me, you need to do this, Anita. It's not Mabo, but this is really significant for our people. And there's things they cannot take. I mean, they took our kids. They've taken the right for income, to control your own income in the Northern Territory. They've taken land. They can't legally take away your right to identify. And I mean, I know who I am. I didn't go to court to say, I want to prove to you who I am. Mm. Well, I went to court because I wanted to say, you cannot, as a journalist, use your position to incite racial hatred by saying what you said. So the process was quite long. Obviously, this happened in April. The first, all we wanted, we didn't want to go to court. We wanted an apology and for the article to come off the web and the blog. Meanwhile, there's all these comments. I don't know if, how many, did anybody read the comments on the blog by chance? They know the articles that were written. So I obviously had to read the articles, and I was upset that my name had now become part of a process of facilitating race hate by people who'd never met me. He didn't know me. He'd never read my work. And so there's hundreds of comments by people just hiding behind anonymous email addresses and so forth. There's clearly no monitoring going on. The only time Andrew Bolt appeared on the blog was when he was challenging a black fella who wrote something on the blog, and then he only challenged their identity.
You would have known, though, that the white legal system hasn't done Indigenous Australians too many favours over the years. So you would have known you're throwing yourself into this arena. You're feeling like there's an issue of justice at stake here. But on the other hand, you would have thought, God, you know, we might not win.
Well, I have to, I never, You're absolutely right, and I've written it in my book, but I never believed we wouldn't win because of that very reason, because the legal system has not done justice for us in terms of black deaths in custody, in terms of native title, and I thought at some point, if not the legal system, then the freaking universe had to go, it's our turn. Mm. But I also knew, when I made my final decision, I was driving along in the city and I'd had lots of conversations. I think for my family, it was never a question, and you're going to do this. Not in a bad way. It was just like, this is who you are. We know you're going to do this and it'll be fine either way. But I was talking to Robin Quiggan on the phone and I said, look, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I've never been to court. I don't know how this works. And she said to me, you've got some of the best legal counsel in the country. And of course, we have a fantastic legal team in Ron Merkel and Herman Bernstein and Phoebe Knowles and so forth. And she said, you can bet your bottom dollar they're not going into this to lose. And she said, they know their stuff. They wouldn't even be attempting this if they didn't believe that there was an honest, integral case to fight. So I got some faith from that. And then, of course, it all goes ahead. And it's this long process. It's a really long, drawn-out, painful, annoying process because we think we're going to court in December of 2010 and I'm freaking out because it's the same week that Oprah's coming to Sydney and I'm saying to the lawyer, I didn't want to say, I really can't go to Melbourne because I'm one of like a few thousand people out of hundreds of thousands who got tickets to go to Oprah and I'm seriously freaking out about this. And my mother's graduating with that week. She's being given an honorary doctorate from Notre Dame University, which is on one day and Oprah's on the other day. And I had to make a choice. I had to make a choice. So anyway, we think we go in December. So that I'm reading, going, having to read, rereading the blogs, sitting at my desk, sobbing. And I felt physically unsafe. I thought I wanted to change my parents' phone number because I thought if these people are that crazy enough to think that it's okay to write the shit that they were writing, I mean, I think it demonstrated to me there's a lot of people who are unwell in our society, unchecked, to think that it's completely all right to say the things they were saying and not be challenged by anybody else, that there's something wrong. And I felt physically unsafe. And reading it also, I thought to myself, this is like Nazi Germany. This is still this real belief that we are a lower specimen on this planet.
So it's an insight really into what some people in Australia think, and a scary insight.
I was scared. I was really scared. I mean, I won't lie to you, I go to these events always thinking there'll be somebody in the audience that is here who's not here to support, that is here for a completely different reason. Mm. And I've been getting tweets from some lunatic this week that is also, and it unnerves you. Mm. People say you just ignore it, but I just go, who goes out of their way to do stuff like that? So it's December, I'm rereading the blogs, I'm crying, I'm in my office, my office mate's going, what's wrong? And I said, this makes me feel sick to the stomach. We end up not going to court the following week, which is great for Oprah and Mum. But what it means is I feel sick until March, until I go to court.
The agony drags on and on.
But the interesting thing is, I wanted to go to court because I wanted to have my say. By this point, I'm like, you know what? Put me on the stand. Yep. I already know I'm smarter than you are, right? And then in his witness statement to the court, we all wrote really long witness statements, 30 pages, between 15 and 30 pages, all nine of us. The response to all of our witness statements from him was like 9 pages in total. It was like this utter contempt for the legal system and for us. But in his witness statement to me, he claimed that he used a photo of my mother off the web to determine, on her wedding day, to determine that she was part Aboriginal and therefore, you know, clearly I couldn't be Aboriginal. The photo that they submitted into their witness statement came off my blog on, I think it was the 12th of February, 2011. He wrote his article in 2009, right? So I go to Melbourne to go to court. So I go, you know, yes, put me up there. I'm ready. Mm. And I, you know, knew what I was. And I have nothing to hide. Like, my life is an open book. So still single. And so I'm ready. I go down to Melbourne on the Sunday and I meet Bindi Cole for the first time. We're in chambers with Herman and Ron Phoebe, and we're being, you know, they only want you for half an hour, Anita. I'm thinking, well, how much damage can I do in half an hour? You know, like, really, to myself. No. And I'm fine. I've got a new dress. I've got a new, dress for court.
Mm-hmm.
I said to my lawyer, Ron, Joel Zinger, I said, I'm putting that on the bill if we win. He goes, you might be able to wear it again, Anita. I said, I don't intend going to court again, Joel. Had a new dress, had my nice shoes on. Anyway, so it... The morning comes. I actually have a really good night's sleep, which surprises me because I suffer from anxiety.
Mm.
And it surprised me. But I had a good night's sleep because I felt I knew that I had done nothing wrong.
You were confident.
None of us had done anything wrong. Mm. Surely that had to mean something.
Mm.
Get up in the morning, lots of text messages from people supporting, go to court. And I'm not kidding. From the minute till 10 o'clock, I was hoping that his lawyers would say to him, you're not going to win.
Mm.
Just make the apology. Let's move on. Didn't happen. So we get into court. They'd called, interesting, out of the nine, they call four people, all women, right? We get into courtroom and they're reading out, you know, who is speaking to her, and I've been dropped. So within that 24 hours, somebody's actually jigged that, oh, we can't put her on the stand. Mm. And on top of that, I was a little bit darker than they expected me to be.
Mm.
Pity he used, like, the overexposed photo of Anita. No. So what, at recess, lunchtime, little lunch, whatever we call it, I said, do you think maybe I'm a little bit darker than they thought? You know, and because I'd spent a bit of time in the sun. And no, I'm kidding. And so I was actually disappointed that I didn't get to have my say, but I stayed there to watch, you know, Pat on the stand. She was amazing, Pat Etock, and Bindi and so forth. And then, of course, we have to wait all those months.
That's right. You don't get the ruling that day, do you? In fact, you don't turn
September 28th.
And you don't go to the court to see the ruling. You're in another state watching it, I think.
I was in Redfern. I went into Redfern and sat in the National Centre for Indigenous Excellence and sat in the boardroom of NASCA. But I...
Just waiting and waiting.
But, you know, the whole time... See, now I'm getting my say now. The whole time, I go, right, I'm going to go down the day because we're going to win and I'm going to be there and I'm going to have my say on the steps. Well, they don't even have steps at this court. Like, you know, on the TV, I stand on the steps and all the media will be there and I have a new dress on. And then what happened was, the week before I get the phone call going, we've got judgment. It's going to be on the 28th September, which, mind you, was the day after the deadlies. You know, one's a bit dusty the day after the deadlies.
Mm.
Okay. Mm. So I go, oh, that's not good. But all of a sudden I panicked and I thought, what if we don't win? I mean, it's about the law. What if the judge goes, you've done this, this, this and this. You're a terrible journalist, but you haven't actually breached the Racial Discrimination Act. I didn't want to be in that space because I would have been absolutely devastated. Not about losing, because it would have given him a mandate to just keep writing all this stuff that generated race hate. And I would have had to leave the country. And I would have felt responsible for the young people that I was trying to save from that intimidation.
Mm.
So I talked to my publisher and my life coach and my mum. And anyway, so I decided to stay. I go into Redfern. Court goes in at 10:15. Media's already ringing me looking for a statement, but we'd already decided don't talk to the media. If we lose, definitely don't talk to the media.
Mm.
And if we win, I had already written a statement. And so 10:15, 10:20, I'm getting text messages from my friends telling me who's in the court and so forth. And within 20 minutes, I got a text from somebody saying, you've won.
Mm.
And it was just, you know, it was like it was worth all the drama.
Mm.
And then, of course, the media go crazy with, oh, free speech. Oh, no, we've lost our free speech. No, you lost. Sorry, how much free speech do you want? You don't want free speech. You want the right to racially vilify someone, and that's two different things.
Mm.
So then you've got to sit back and watch all the different parties, you know, carry on about how they... People who are talking about their jobs, essentially, when I'm talking about my life.
Mm, because the whole verdict really opened up that whole... So you live through this prolonged legal process, you finally win, and then upon winning, a whole debate spins out of control following it, doesn't it, about people who say, oh, well, you mightn't agree with what Andrew Bolt says, but, you know, he's got the right to free speech, and you have to deal with all of that as well.
And we're not even in that debate.
Yeah.
You know, that's obvious, but by then I was exhausted. I was so tired, sorry. I just sat back and watched, like, you know, you guys can have the argument, because it was basically people in media, and I had broadcasters that I respect and journalists that I previously respected text me on the day saying, you know, justice and so forth, but didn't say anything publicly. And, you know, that's just not good enough for me. We've got nothing. Anita Heiss has got nothing to lose. That's why, as black fellas, we can say and do what we want because we're not in the game. Mm. We've got nothing to lose. We're still fighting for basic human rights in this country. It doesn't really matter what Anita Heiss says.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm not protecting a job or anything. I'm not going to get sacked by an employer. I work for myself. So, and all these people were having this debate, but at no time did people who said were arguing for free speech, did they actually unpack what he said and actually unpack what was said on the blogs? None of them actually talked about racial vilification. Mm. I was told earlier today, now he writes on his blog things when something happens in the press about black fellas, I can't comment on this because, you know, he's been silenced. And it was brought to my attention today. The court never told him he couldn't write. The court told him he had to write and present things in good faith. It was suggested to me, it's the lawyers in the newsroom saying, like, you need to shut the F up because it's costing us millions of dollars. And so no journalist was told that they couldn't talk about black fellas or that they could. They were told to actually do it within the legal boundaries. It does not incite racial hatred.
A final question on this, because there's much more to the Anita Heiss story than just Bolt. You said afterwards this is quite possibly the most important thing you'll ever do in your life. Mm. Why so? Why do you feel that way?
Because, I mean, when I was in the courtroom, I sat there and I thought to myself, I thought about my grandmother who was lived under the Act of Protection till her 20s and was removed at the age of 6. And I thought about our old people who, I shouldn't say that old now, but, you know, old people who marched. And I thought about the 1938 Day of Mourning. I thought about Windradyne who marched our mob over the mountains and lost lives to say, you know, for the Wiradjuri. And all I had to do was sit in a court of law in an air-conditioned room in a new frock and fight. But, you know, the one thing we've got, I said it before, that they can't take away is who we are. I mean, we're still fighting for land. We still know it's ours, but legally we've got to get it. But I thought this was too important to me, and I didn't do it for me, for Anita. Like I said, I know who I am. My nieces and nephews, they're all fairer than me, you know. And the other thing is, I sat there and I thought, what other group in Australian society would have to sit in a court of law to defend their right to be who they are? None. No other group would have to do that.
This is Big Ideas on RN or at abc.net.au/radio national. I'm Paul Barclay, and tonight I'm talking with Aboriginal writer, commentator and performer, really, Anita Heiss, author of Am I Black Enough For You? To podcast this or any program or express your views, head to our website at abc.net.au/radio national and navigate your way to Big Ideas. I'll be reading out some of your brickbats and bouquets on recent Big Ideas programs a little later on. Also, you can tweet us right now or follow us. Our address is at RN Big Ideas. We welcome your views on all Big Ideas programs, but a reminder, please be civil and refrain from offensive comments. Difference of opinion is fine. Abuse is not. Let me take you back now to the Avid Reader bookstore and Anita Heiss, who's a strong believer in educating students about Indigenous Australia to combat some of the ignorance and myths she says exist in the community.
The problems we have in our society in terms of race relations, I believe, stem from what's not being taught in the classroom at all levels in every state. I'm an advocate for a national curriculum so that everyone's on an even playing field. I do a lot of work in schools, and I hate to say it because I love being here in Queensland. As belated as it is, I didn't know how to weave it into the first question. I do acknowledge country. I feel like I'm a pseudo-Murray at times because I'm here so much now, and I go the Maroons. But I do, but the seriousness of this is I do. Classrooms in Queensland seem to be a lot further behind in their very basic knowledge of Australia's First Peoples, and it mortifies me.
How does that manifest itself? Are they saying things in class that are demonstrating their ignorance, or do they just know anything?
Sometimes I do a really basic demographic thing. Where do you think most Aboriginal people live? And everybody will say, oh, the Northern Territory and the desert and so forth. I say, well, you know, one third of it Aboriginal and Torres Islander Australia live in urban centres. One fifth of our people live in Greater Sydney, and so forth. Or I did an exercise at a school, fantastic school, and it's not a criticism about the school. Again, it's about the curriculum that teachers are given. Where we were doing a thing on national identity, Australian identity, and I said, let's go around the room and everybody give me one word or one phrase that gives them that. They think of when they think of national Australian identity. And like, no, I'm standing up the front and I've already done a whole lot of, you know, brown things. And nobody says anything about Indigenous Australia. I don't blame the students. I don't. Mm. I don't necessarily even blame the teachers. I blame the fact that it's not seen as something important enough for Australian students to learn about how this country came to be, how we came to be where we are. And it manifests itself in numbers of ways where journalism like that happens and the blog comments happen and people don't understand why black fellas don't want to participate on January 26. Mm. It's because they don't know their history.
Yeah, you call for, I think, compulsory education about pre-colonial times in schools. I think you also mentioned in the book, though, that you think this should extend through to university as well, because I think you say it's surprising the number of people at university level who are ignorant about this.
It's interesting. I got into this massive Twitter debate a few weeks ago because I had said, somebody had asked me a question, and I said, I don't think that any student should be graduating from any Australian tertiary institution without having done at least one unit of Indigenous studies, regardless of whether it being a teacher, a banker, a lawyer, or whatever, that should be compulsory, particularly in media, that they do one unit and teaching. And I made some comment that I believed it would make for better Australians. And then I got, you know, pounced on by someone saying, you're saying that I can't be a good Australian unless I know about Aborigines. And I said, well, I think you would be a better Australian if you knew about all Australians. And yes, the Aborigines, are you an anthropologist? Seriously. No, yes, you would be a better Australian, I think, if you knew about your First Nations peoples. And, of course, we don't even use that language in this country. We don't say First Nations because you know what that means, First Peoples. Then everybody else has to be Second Peoples, and nobody celebrates coming second, as Michael McDaniel would say.
Look, I mean, I think the great thing about the book is it tackles this stereotype of, as I said, what it is to be black in Australia. And, you know, it is often white people that foster that stereotype. And you know the stereotype, black people live in the outback, they speak in their own language or languages, they love to go and spear animals and they love camping and they're encyclopedic about every aspect of Aboriginal culture and all of the challenges that we face as a country. But this book is really about saying that you can be black and not be like that as well. You can be black and you can like to go shopping and you can still have a clear sense of your cultural identity at the same time.
You introduced me, now you've just given me a chance to say it. That's what this is about, really, saying this is one story to say, you know, being black is far more complex than just writing a quick article about saying you need to look like this, you need to do this, you need to do this. You said something about, I hate the bush and I don't like camping. Now, it's not that I hate the bush or the desert, I just don't like getting dirty and dusty. And I don't hate camping. I'm camped at the Sofitel tonight and I'm very happy. You know. But I have had a black...
You don't even like caravans, actually.
I had a black fella say to me at the Dreaming Festival a few years ago, made some comment about, oh, you're joking, but you're not really black because, you know, you don't want to sleep under the stars. I'm like, yeah, five stars, brother. You know, like, I'm staying in a hotel, wherever we're back in Caboolture, I think. I said, you can be as cold as you like tonight. I said, but I've got an electric blanket and don't be thinking you're using my hot water. So I said, like, my mother was born in a Humpy. They swept dirt floors. I said, you might be going backwards. I said, why did they work so hard so we could have houses and shit? You know, like, that's crazy people.
You must find yourself in situations, though, where people assume that because you're black, you like camping and you travel around the country a lot. So in spite of the fact that you don't really dig sleeping under the stars, you must find situations where you're confronted with the expectation that you will?
All the time. And I just go, they'll ask me something about, you know, bush foods or something. I'm like, how do I know? I'm going to get my kangaroo in Coles. Like, how, I grew up in the city like you, knowing who I was all my life. But it doesn't mean that, I mean, people are like, this is the whole point.
Yeah.
Why is it that other societies can evolve and change and become cosmopolitan and multicultural? We marry someone else, we're watering down our bloodlines and we're straddling two worlds and we're losing touch with our roots and so forth.
Do you get a hard time, though, for not conforming to that stereotype that you're very much the living embodiment of a challenge too?
Not so much anymore, because I'm having lots of fun tonight, but I can be pretty scary. You don't want to mess with me, really? And apparently now, I didn't know this, because someone said, they're not going to do anything to you because everybody knows you're litigious now. I had to look that word up. But no, not so much now. I mean, in my community, people know who I am.
Yeah.
Like, I'm really lucky. I'm lucky that I grew up, my family are known and so forth. I'm more fortunate. It's a terrible thing to say. It's a terrible thing to be privileged. To feel privileged as a child that you had two parents, that you weren't removed. You know, it's a terrible thing to feel guilty that you're lucky because you know your parents and you know your family and you know all your cousins and so forth. So in my community, that's all taken. That's fine. Most people now, sometimes at writers' festivals, people will say pretty silly things, but that's why I don't take questions from the floor.
I liked reading the story of your family, though.
Yeah.
It's a lovely part of the book. You're very close to your dad, who's Austrian with a penchant for DIY furniture, and your mum, who's a strict Catholic, and so much love and closeness in the family that you really do get the impression that everything you've gone on to achieve later in life really had its roots in a great upbringing and a great family life. Do you think that? Absolutely.
And so I can see when I go into classrooms and so forth the difference that it makes when kids have that kind of support from home. And it does make a difference. I mean, my mum finished school at 15 originally because she got sick and so forth, and didn't go back to study till she was 42 when she did one of those, in those days it was called a CAED course through Tranby, you know, the Certificate of Adult Basic Education, and finished at Randwick TAFE and everything. And she did like year 10 and so forth. My dad left school at 14. He, you know, come from one cow farming village in the Lungau, Salzburg, and he was a simple man. Smart in many other ways, but, you know, easily pleased, just fell in love with my mother, and that was it. They couldn't even talk because he didn't speak very much English when he met her, learned English very quickly because he just fell in love with her immediately. This is why I'm like the hopeless romantic, because can I tell you the story about my parents? Can I?
Yeah.
So my father gets – my mum's living in Redfern. I think it's Edward Street, Redfern, with her Auntie Mary, so my great-aunt Mary. And she's waitressing in Sydney and working at, you know, the fantails, lollies?
Yep.
She used to make the boxes that the fantails go in. And my mum was so skinny, her wedding dress fit me in fourth class. You know, take it up but don't take it in. It was very scary. She was so skinny. But anyway, so she's working and she's waitressing, and she knew an Austrian woman called Lee. Now, my father had got an assisted passage to Sydney from Austria. Urban myth has it he got on the wrong boat. He was meant to go to Canada with the other Austrians, ends up in Sydney, learns the key things he needs to know in English, you know, beer, chocolate, and, you know, beer schooner and something else. Anyway, he goes to Tasmania, spends 2 years, pays his fare off, comes and lives in a hostel with other Austrians in Sydney, and meets my mother at a party but doesn't speak English very well. She just giggles, and he's speaking to her. It's not even in German. It's this like Lungau dialect, right? And he then pursues my mother, and on their first date, my great auntie Mary said, "You need to be careful because you know these new Australians carry knives." No, I know, it's so ridiculous. But look, I tell this in the book because the point of the story is about saying how racism went both ways in those days and how their love overcame all of that. So Auntie Mary says, you've got to go somewhere close to home so you can run home if something happens. So they go to the... I know, isn't it lovely? It's lovely. And so they go to this cinema in Lawson Street, Redfern, and they see a Greek film. Neither of them speak Greek. And they weren't pashing at all, sure. My mother's very strict Catholic. And so they go to this, and he doesn't stab her, obviously. And anyway, but then my mum tells me that the stories where she'd be up in the morning and my grandparents would go, "Oh, for God's sake, Elsie, will you go and talk to that Dago or whatever term they use. Mm. He's been driving up and down the street since 5 o'clock this morning, or he's been sitting on the step. And my first boyfriend used to do the same thing. And I never understood why until later on. Like, he'd be standing outside under a tree in the rain, and my parents would come in and say, "Why is he standing? Let the Met boy in." And I could never see why they took his side, because he was like my father, right? But in the 80s, it's stalking. In the 60s, it's courting. So my mother used to go dancing at Australian Hall, which was obviously the site of the Day of Mourning protest and conference in 1938, and they'd all go dancing on a Friday night, and my father wouldn't go in. He would wait outside for her for a number of reasons. One, because of the language thing. And while my mum's female friends, they loved Dad, they just laughed because they didn't know what he was saying. But the men saw it as a slight that she wasn't dating a black fella. So, and I mean, it's hard to talk about that because it makes me sad that someone treated my dad badly. But, and obviously my mother didn't want any of this in the book. Like, "Mum, this is the story, though. This is the good story. The good story is that you both overcame. He didn't listen to his friends. You know, my grandfather didn't walk my mother down the aisle. He stood out the front at the church in St. Vincent's and said, 'I could never give my baby girl away.' But we know it was because she was marrying a new Australian. But once she got married, that was it. My grandfather James said, 'Elsie's made a choice and he's in the family.' And we're at a funeral in Griffith. I think it was my Uncle Kevin's funeral, years and years and years later. Obviously, I drove, so it was in my 20s, I think. And someone yells out across the wake in the hall, eating the egg sandwiches, you know, 'Oh, Elsie, I didn't know Joe was a wog. I thought he was Corey.'" Right? Which is racist and endearing at the same time. And my father is chuffed by this because he's got a sense of belonging in a country where he's never belonged.
Now, I won't talk about the time as an academic, but I did like that moment in Fiji where you're at an epistemology conference and you have this moment of clarity when you think, no, this is not really for me, being an academic. And anyway, you stop being an academic and one thing leads to another and you become...
Can I just stop you and ask a question?
Epistemology.
How many people in their everyday lives... I know there's a couple of academics in the room, so you're not going to say anything. Use the word epistemology. Right. I got a PhD and I was going to a conference and I was just saying to myself, every time I said to a black fellow, "I'm going to this epistemology conference," they go, "Epistawatch?" And I just go, I cannot be part of a process where I'm using a language that our mom don't even use, I mean, about ourselves. And I just found it quite fascinating. So I just go, this is not for me. Yeah. Sorry.
You're the only person I've met, though, who has been an academic sufficiently qualified to attend an epistemology conference who goes on to become the only Indigenous chick lit writer in the country, quite possibly actually the only black commercial fiction writer probably in Australia. That's quite a journey. How did you get to this situation where you become the Currie Bradshaw of Australian literature?
Clearly I've got a commitment issue. Did I tell you I'm single? All right, no, there is a purpose, because every single book I've written has had a specific purpose. Mm. And so I read most of my books lying on the beach or in bed, and I read fantastic Australian literature by a lot of Australian women who I love and adore and who have mentored me, but I never saw on the pages anyone like me or any of my circle of friends that I went to university with who are, you know, a lot of them are lawyers, and I'm sitting at the table going, I write chick lit, feeling completely intimidated and inadequate. No, and I'm thinking, you know, none of these women are talking about the things that we talk about when we sit around. Yeah, we talk about shopping and boys and sometimes girls, but we also talk about, you know, things that are important in our community and so forth. And so I was about finding a niche, finding that gap. I wanted to write us into Australian literature, and at the same time, with not meeting Mr. Wright, purge myself of 15 years of bad dates. Two in one. And I never imagined I'd be doing another one. And then that went sold very quickly, sold well very, very quickly, and the publishers, we need another one. So I go, where do I want to research? Oh, Melbourne's a good place. Lots of single men in Melbourne. So I take myself to Melbourne and write Avoiding Mr. Wright. And it's interesting because I wanted to talk about Palm Island and black deaths in custody in my first book. And my agent said, "Nita, this is your first book. It's going into Big W. It's commercial women's fiction. You can't have Palm Island on page 3, you know." So, but I'd already built an audience with the first book. So the second book, you know, the character Peter Tully, he's moving to Melbourne and working for Domsaria, which is the Department of Sports, Media, Arts, Refugees and Indigenous Affairs, and meets this cop, Mike, and who asks her out. And this is based on something that really happened with me. I went out with a policeman once, and maybe twice. And no. But we hadn't even ordered, so I've used it. He was fine. He was, you know, quite flattered to be, even though it was a tragic story, to be used. We're sitting down, and so I write it into the story, and he's got a blue band on his wrist. You know, there's charity. Oh, you all know what it is? Yeah. It's charity, but I didn't know. Hadn't even ordered a drink by this stage. And I said, what's that for? And he said, oh, I don't think you're going to like it. Clearly not a very bright guy. I should have at least taken it off for the day, one would think. And I said, what's it for? He says, Chris Hurley. And I, the funny thing is, before I got there that day, I already had conversations with five different people saying, this is not possible. How can I have a date with a cop? And they're going, you don't have to talk about black deaths in custody on your first date. I'm going, yes, you do. I'm not wasting 6 weeks. You know, life's short. Anyway, so then I've just, and I had already just done something for the ABC. So I was just going, bang, 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 bang. And he's like, oh, you just need to calm down. I'm going to get us a drink. Piss me off even more. And so, but what it, I could then write that into the novel. So the thing is, they call it chick lit, but to me it's much more than that. That's why I prefer to call it commercial women's fiction, because the storylines, while I use relationships to drive the story, it's really about me getting issues like interracial relationships, successful Aboriginal women, urban cultures and so forth, black deaths in custody, Indigenous intellectual property and so forth, into a mainstream audience for women, who usually 18 to 45-year-old audiences, and increasingly more men are buying my books. There's a man here tonight who's been at every one of my events, and yeah, I'm going to get security at some point.
I'm looking out trying to see who it could possibly be, actually.
You better buy a book tonight. But increasingly more men are buying these books, and I don't think it's because they want to read about relationships. Maybe they do want to read. If they do read them, they're probably going to be scared of women. But I think there is an interest. It's like people want to learn about our cultures, our evolving cultures and so forth in various ways, films, theatre, or, you know, all through a book.
But you get a bit of snobbishness about, do you? Or do people look down their nose at the and think, oh, you know, it's all too mainstream and commercial or not?
I think there's an appalling literary hierarchy in our country that says things like books that I write or chick lit are of lower value, social value and literary value than
literary fiction.
So I get it. That's a bit of a bug of mine, because what they're saying is the stories that we're writing about Australian women are not of value. But that's also then saying that Australian women are not of value. So that shits me a little bit, or a lot bit.
You're getting those stories out there to people who otherwise wouldn't be reading that type of content, I suppose.
And Manhattan Dreaming's been optioned for a film.
Wow.
It's going to be very hard to go to New York to film that.
And you went to New York to research the book, and you were there when Barack Obama was inaugurated. That must have been a special day.
You really did read the book.
Yeah, I read the book.
I was in Harlem the day that it was interesting. So I get the train up. I think it was 115th or 125th. Jump in a cab, and they don't have cabs; they have cars. So you flag down a car, and the guy says he's fascinated that myself and my Australian friend are interested in the American elections. And I'm like, we are the 51st state of the USA, and he just wants to talk about kangaroos. And so we go there, and this is in my top 10 days of my life, because that morning I was up in Harlem, and I'll tell you about the night later. That's a bit strange, but anyway. So I'm up in Harlem, and we get to the hall, the Armory Hall, where they're having the event, and people, there's busloads, thousands of kids coming and chanting Obama. It's freezing cold, it's like below zero, and people are just standing in the street, and there's this amazing energy. And, I mean, US politics is theatre. I mean, seriously, it's scary theatre, expensive, scary theatre. But there is a passion for their politicians that we don't have here. We don't have it here. No one will ever have the passion for our politicians like they have for Obama, for instance, and how he brought people to the polls who had never voted in their life, you know. So that was just amazing. And then that night, it was January 19, and it was Australia Week, or G'day USA, because we all walk around saying G'day, apparently. And somebody said, my friend said, the dollar was like 66 cents, so I was trying not to, like, eat or do anything because it's so expensive. But someone said, oh, do you want to go to this, you know, Australians Do Broadway thing? I didn't even know who was on the bill. I go, yeah, yeah, get me a ticket. With the exchange, it was like $200. And I fell off my chair. I said, I better get like 2,000 words out of this tonight, right? So we go, and it's Olivia Newton-John and Jimmy Barnes. But Gurumul Unipingu sang. And I'd been working in the arts. I used to be a publicist for the Australia Council, and I'd been around the arts for a long, long time. And never in my life had I ever had an emotional reaction as I did that night. I was sitting there like Julie Roberts in Pretty Woman, watching the Pirates of Penzance, and couldn't stop crying. And I'm taking notes the whole time, trying to take notes so I could write about it, so I could write it off on tax. And I need to have proof that I was there. I got some work out of it. Anyway, and my friends are going, "You all right?" But he's singing. He's this amazing voice that comes from somewhere in another, from another universe, singing, performing on stage in one of the world's most prestigious cultural venues, man-made cultural venues. Also, William Barton played the didge, sang in language, played the didge and the electric guitar at the same time. Not sure why, but it was, people loved it. And Ursula Jovic sang Somewhere Over the Rainbow from Australia the Movie. And he's this Koori girl from out near Lapa, sitting in a box, what, in New York on the day that Obama was inaugurated, watching the, yeah. Well, I know, I get shivers all the time.
Yeah, it's a special night, isn't it?
It was extraordinary. Now, my character, she had a good time and everything. Was she on a date that night? Because on the night of Obama's the victory, she actually got to have victory sex. I didn't. But, you know, that's the other good thing about writing fiction. You can write the sex you wished you were having, which is why my mum doesn't read them. My brothers, I give them all books, right? I swear to God, I think they sell them on eBay. Every time I see one on eBay, I text it. That better not be from you. But like Mark said, I can't read it. I can't, in case it's any sex. I go, Mark, none of it's anything I've ever done. Like, really?
Okay, a final question. You're a massive fan of Oprah.
I'm a massive... I was going to wear my Oprah... I got an Oprah pearl because I went to see Oprah in Sydney. As you know, because I couldn't go to court.
What is it about... I mean, this is quite possibly the best-known black woman in the world, I suppose.
She's pretty much probably one of the best-known women.
People in the world, yeah.
She's undoubtedly the most powerful, more powerful than any of the politicians in terms of her influence.
So what is it about her that you love? Because as you see, you're one of the very few people to get tickets to see her in Australia.
I know, the universe.
And you're
was
over
kind.
The moon about it.
Was. Do you know that day, I also got a publishing contract, if you don't mind, so
yeah,
I should have bought a lottery ticket, yeah. Which, you know, she came from nothing. She had a terrible childhood. She went into an industry in like late teens where there were no black women. I mean, there's hardly any women, let alone black women. She became an anchor on a team with a man who didn't want an old female anchor and certainly didn't want a black female anchor. And then, you know, gets invited to go to Chicago to test for a chat show. And Phil Donahue, I think it was you read the book, was it Phil Donahue?
He was you wrote the book.
I know, but you know, I've written a couple of books since then. Who created the whole chat show genre. I'm fairly sure that she beat his ratings in the first 2 days. And she talked about, because I've looked at this because I want to be in Australia's Oprah. Mm. I want to have the A on the Harbour Bridge. And that's not A for Aborigine people. It's A for Anita. And so I've looked at it going, what is the key to her success? The key to her success is she's genuinely interested in the people that she has on her show, genuinely interested in their stories, that she promotes this notion of being positive and grateful. I started a grateful blog because she does this, you know, keeps a grateful journal. Mm. She teaches people how to be the joy of generosity. Now, clearly she's got a lot of money, so she can be generous in different ways that we can be generous, but she teaches people the joy of being generous. And I watched all the videos. I was watching them because we were preparing this show for myself. I think I need a high show. Used to be the Oprah Winfrey Show. It used to be the Ellen DeGeneres Show. And they'd just be going to Oprah, Ellen, Anita. And so some of you will remember she was taken to court by the Texas Cattlemen's Association. Mm. So I was watching this episode where she's in court. They have to do the show in Texas for 6 weeks. She's done a show on mad cow disease and at some point has said something along the lines of, you know, I think I'll never eat another hamburger again, which nearly cripples the cattle industry. That's how powerful she is, right? They take her to court and she's in the courtroom and the lawyer, I'm watching, she's telling the story, that the lawyer is yelling at her and you're this, this and this. And in her head she goes, I'm not who he says I am. And that's what got me through the case. Mm. I go, all I just need to be going, yeah, you can say all that. Mm. That's not who I am. And it's as simple as that. But I also watched her. She also says you cannot facilitate change when you are angry. Mm. And I still see in our community, obviously people are angry. I'm angry, but I understand now, as you get older, that you can't make change in a room full of people when you're angry or if they're angry. And I know I have a lovely, loyal following because, I'm nice. No, because I choose to be positive. I make a conscious choice to be positive. Mm. And I learnt that, part of that I learnt from her because I've seen she has become successful because she's genuine, because she's generous, and because she chooses to, she says, my role in life is to facilitate other people telling their stories. Now, in some ways, I do that. Like Mary Talents is about stolen generations. I wasn't removed, but I was telling the story for those who didn't have access to publishing. So, you know, lots of people, blackfellas criticise Oprah, but I think she's quite extraordinary.
Well, look, you're not just positive. You are, without doubt, the most enthusiastic and exuberant person that we've interviewed here. It's been an absolute pleasure. I know the audience has loved it. Will you please thank Anita Heiss? Anita Heiss, author of Am I Black Enough For You, which is published by Bantam, thanks to Avid Reader.